This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 380 for June 2nd of 2017, Why I Quit the UAW and Voted for Trump. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right. Everybody on the set, shut up because the show has started.
Okay.
Gary, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you? After the warning to shut up, I think I'll say nothing. No, I'm doing great. And you?
I just got here. I was up at Mackinac Island for the policy conference, but I wanted to be here for this show. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I drove straight back and
did
here.
Break any speed limits?
No comment. Okay. And we got to let everybody know we got Daron Levine here. Daron is a grizzled veteran of automotive journalism and has got his own radio program on Sirius Radio right now. So spit out a few syllables. Tell us about it.
Okay, so the show is in the driver's seat. It's every Saturday at noon on Insight 121 for an hour. I have guests, many of the same guests that John does and a few that he doesn't. And we talk about everything automotive from cars to crossovers to driverless cars and stocks and bonds and everything having to do with the automobile industry.
And let's see, you've worked for the Wall Street Journal, right?
Yeah, bureau chief for the New York Times, worked for Bloomberg, Detroit Free Press, and I'm waiting for a gig with the Weekly Reader.
Hence my term, grizzled veteran.
Yes, grizzled.
Can't hold a job on their own.
And we got to let everybody know our special guest for the day is Brian Pannebecker, and former UAW worker who still is working at Ford Sterling Heights plant. I got that right.
Correct, yeah.
And you've been there, what, 21 years?
Almost 21. This fall will be 21 years.
And then you worked at Chrysler another 11 before that?
78 to 89, I worked for Chrysler Corporation, the old Chrysler Corporation, when their world headquarters was in Highland Park, which is where I was based.
Okay, so I met Brian a couple of months ago on a local television program here, and I was intrigued by, here's a guy who quit the UAW, and even more than quit the UAW, he was able to do so because he led the fight, or was part of the fight, within Michigan to create right-to-work laws. And right-to-work means you don't have to join a union if you don't want to. And so, Brian, I'm dying to ask you. I mean, the union's done a lot for working-class people.
Absolutely.
In the automotive industry.
Absolutely.
And you're a great beneficiary of all their hard work.
Absolutely.
And yet you go and quit.
Yep.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you why. Collective bargaining is a great process and very, very important, and you're correct. It's the people who led the fight to get unions accepted in Michigan and in the United States really sacrificed and stuck their necks out, and I am indebted to those folks. But that was back in the 30s and 40s, and we're talking about 70, 80 years ago, John. Now, what's happened since about the 1970s, the unions, pretty much a lot of the things that they fought for, at least in my opinion, have been integrated into federal law, safety measures and work conditions and, you know, the 40-hour work week and overtime pay and the whole ball of wax has been written into federal law. And we're not working under the kind of conditions that people in factories were working under in the early 1900s, in the 20s and 30s, when unions really had a reason to fight for the type of things that they got from management back in that time period. And I think since about the 1970s, unions have become more a political organization that has turned into an organization that's fighting for political causes as opposed to a collective bargaining agent for the workforce out on the floor. So that was my main concern with them. And just to let your viewers know, the point I fought for right to work because I thought it would give the workers some leverage in their dealings with their elected officials in the union. Because if we have a choice whether or not we pay the union leadership or not, I felt that it would give the workers more of a say and more leverage over their elected officials. And what really caused me to leave the union, because I used to go to my union meetings, I used to be vocal within the union, even while I was fighting for right to work, what caused me to leave the union was the end of 2014, as we were approaching the 2015 contract talks, the union leadership announced to the membership that our strike fund had mysteriously lost $300 million. Our strike fund had accumulated $960 million. We're talking about almost $1 billion. Now, that's money that's taken out of the UAW's general fund and put into a separate fund to be used in case we go on strike. Well, strikes are very rare, and that fund had accumulated and built up to almost $1 billion. So all of a sudden, it went from $950 million down to $600 million, and they announced that they were going to put a proposal out at the pre-contract talk convention down at Cobo to raise our dues by 25% from 2 hours a month of our salary or pay up to 2.5 hours to replenish our strike fund so that we could get it back up to the level
and
we
you
need.
Wanted to know where it all
And
went.
I wanted to know where it went. So I ran for convention delegate. At that time, I was still in the UAW. I ran for convention delegate at my plant. We were going to be allotted 4 convention delegates to go to the international meeting down at Cobo to vote on this issue. I didn't get enough votes to be elected, unfortunately, so I wasn't able to go and speak. And they went down there and held a voice vote to increase the dues on the membership from 2 hours to 2.5 hours with no sunset. So that 2.5 hours is indefinite now. And it passed on a voice vote, so there's no record of who voted for it, who voted against it. Of course, half the people down there claimed to have voted against it because it was just a bad thing for them to do. And at that point, I resigned. Right to Work had been passed in 2012 and signed into law by Governor Snyder, and I had the ability under Michigan law now to resign and stop paying any dues whatsoever, and at that point I did that in protest over that missing $300 million.
So do you have any idea where the money is?
No, we were never given an accounting of how that money was used. We were told through our elected local union officials that it was used for organizing efforts down in Tennessee when they were trying to get another vote, the third vote on the UAW to
at Nissan.
Volkswagen.
At Volkswagen.
Oh, at Volkswagen.
Yeah, at Volkswagen. And they'd already held 2 votes, and the workers down there had said no. They'd seen what the UAW had done for the workers in Detroit, and they were getting pretty close to the same pay. They had a 401k retirement plan as opposed to a defined benefit pension plan like the UAW had for its legacy employees. So they had a good retirement plan, 401k plan with a match. They had comparable base pay and great working conditions, and the company treated them like gold. So they didn't want the UAW in there. So they'd voted no twice already. So the UAW said they spent $300 million trying to get a third vote down there, which they eventually did get, and the workers down there said no again. So where did our $300 million go, and why was it taken out of our strike fund without a vote of the membership? So I resigned from the UAW in protest, and they won't get any more dues money from me until I retire.
Do you face daily hostility at all from people you work with because you don't belong to the UAW?
Some people, yes. They're diehard, old-school UAW believers, and yes, there's resentment there to this day. I was getting quite a bit of open hostility from the union local officials, some of them at least, up until about a year ago. I had a specific UAW local official who was following me around the plant, videotaping me. I'm on a high-low, so they were trying to catch me doing anything they could unsafe or in violation of the rules so that they could get me in trouble, get me written up, and get me time off. And long story short, I had to file a formal complaint with the National Labor Relations Board downtown in Detroit at the McNamara Building, and threatened to file a civil lawsuit against my UAW local.
Because they were harassing you.
Because they were harassing me, which they clearly were. And after I filed that formal complaint with the NLRB, the harassment stopped because they saw that I wasn't going to be intimidated and I was going to punch back. And I might add, Daron, that I have a lawyer assigned to me by the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. The gentleman's name is John Rodabaugh. John served on the NLRB under...
I know this guy. He's a lawyer, right?
A lawyer.
Really smart guy.
Really smart. He was on the NLRB under President George Herbert Walker Bush, the first President Bush. He didn't work at the NLRB. He was on the NLRB, and there's only one way to get on the NLRB. You have to be nominated by the President of the United States, and you have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate. That's my lawyer. He's on my cell phone. If I dialed him up right now, he answers his phone. So my union representatives know I have the best legal representation available, and they are my legal representation is just itching for a fight with UAW. So if they continue to harass me, they're going to have a lawsuit on their hands. So the harassment stopped because I fought back. I got good legal representation thanks to the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, and I wasn't afraid to use it.
Brian, tell us about what Sterling Heights is. I mean, we're acting as though everybody on Earth knows what goes on in that factory or even what a factory is like. So give us some context and some color to
what the Sterling
what it's
plant
like.
Where I work is the Sterling Axle Plant, and our primary product is the rear end for the F-150, F-250, and, you know, the heavy-duty pickup trucks. That's our moneymaker. We also make the front-wheel drive units for the Mustang and some of the other components.
Not Mustang. Mustang's rear drive.
Or, excuse me, yeah.
But it has an axle in the front, right?
No, it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't.
But I want to say, don't you guys make the CVT there? You make a transmission there?
No, that's at the Sterling Van Dyke plant.
Oh, Van Dyke.
That's our sister
plant,
which is about a mile away.
I'm confusing the two.
Yeah,
right.
So the Sterling Axle plant is axles. The Sterling transmission plant is called the Van Dyke plant.
Yeah.
But we're sister plants.
Yeah.
And so primarily that's
You probably make front drive half shafts for some
right.
of the front
okay,
drive.
Right.
Okay. So when you say you make these things, is there a lot of machining? Is there a lot of assembly? I mean,
both. And when I first hired in almost 21 years ago, we did a lot of the machining and different, the entire process. Now, a lot of that has been shipped out, and we're buying in some of the components that already have the work done that we used to do in-house. And we're doing primarily the assembly of those products. But when the rear axles for the F-150 leave our plant, they go directly to the assembly plant. They're painted and ready to be installed.
So these are big components and heavy.
Exactly.
This is real manufacturing.
This is heavy duty stuff.
We got to make this clear.
This
is what he's working on.
Sure.
And so, I mean, how many people work there and how big is this place?
Approximately 3,000 people work there right now. They hit a peak back in the heyday of about 8,000. That was... prior to the big downturn around 1980, they were running three shifts round the clock, and that plant was just humming from one side of the plant to the other. Now, when I hired in, they'd gone through a couple downsizings and some tough economic times, and we got down below 2,000 employees. I think we're at a low of about 1,500 at one point, but they've built it back up now. Now we're a two-tier plant, so everybody who comes into our plant, the new people, are all at the lower tier wage that they negotiated with the UAW. So they come in at about $15, $16 an hour, and they top out around $20 an hour. The tier one people, the legacy employees, as they call us, are at about $30 an hour. So they're making about two-thirds of what we make. So we're 100% two-tier. So everybody who comes in, all the new people who come into our plant will come in at that lower tier. Nobody will ever come into our plant and make the top tier. So they're bringing a lot of new work in because the labor costs are significantly lower.
But there is a way, there is a path for those people, some presumably down the road,
yes,
to get to the higher pay.
Yes, because the number of two tiers, part of that negotiation, from my understanding, is there's a cap. It's like 80-20. They can only have 20% or so of their employees that are making that lower tier. So when they reach that, then people...
As people like you retire.
Exactly. Then new people will come in at the lower tier, and then the people who are high seniority in that lower tier will move into the higher tier. There's also another path for them to make full pay, and that's to transfer to a plant where they have... they're not 100% two-tier, like Livonia Transmission. They're expanding their operations, and I know there's an effort to get all the people out of our plant, the tier one people, the legacy people. So as we retire or transfer to places like Livonia, the new people that come in to backfill us will be at the lower tier. So that plant will always be a lower tier, lower wage structure.
So even with the percentage situation, I mean, that will no longer exist?
The 20% I was talking about was corporate-wide.
Oh, okay.
Our plant is 100%. They could have 100% lower-tier workers at our plant, but corporate-wide, it's capped at 20% right now, and that's always subject to negotiations when a new contract is negotiated.
Yeah. Hey, look, we got to take a quick break here. We got to give a shout-out to one of our sponsors. By the way, Trucker Alex wrote in to say he loves your show on Sirius, Daron.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Trucker Alex.
Okay, and right now we're going to take a quick break because we're going to give a good shout-out to our sponsor, Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Hey, we're back talking with Brian Pannebecker, the former UAW worker who's still working in the plant.
So, Brian, first of all, I want to say just on a personal basis, I very much admire you. I think that what you've done and the stand you've taken requires a lot of courage, and good for you for taking it. And
thank
I'm
you.
Sure I'm not the only one, and I'm sure there are plenty of people in the plant who probably are afraid to talk, who probably admire you as well. So good on you. You said that there are 3,000 workers in your plant, and there were once upon a time 8,000 workers. Now, part of that was because you were going more hours, let's say, and more shifts. But part of that is because the car companies, obviously, are trying to keep costs low so that they can be competitive, so that they can sell their cars at a profit and stay in business. That means when they have to pay above market wages for work that they can get elsewhere at a market wage. And I'm not talking about China or Thailand or Mexico. I'm talking about
job shop
Alabama or a non-union shop somewhere else. They go to those places. So obviously this puts a lot of pressure on the UAW. What do you see as the future? What's your vision of where the UAW is going in the future, in this automobile climate of today?
Jerome, my personal opinion, and I'm no auto analyst or expert on the subject, but my personal opinion is the UAW has to face the reality that, you know, we are and have been for a number of years now in a world economy with emerging players and producers from China and Asia and different places that we have to be able to compete with. So the UAW has to realize that things like their defined benefit pension plan is a dinosaur. Now, they have come to that realization in the most recent contract. All the lower-tier new hire workers no longer get a defined benefit pension plan. They're in a 401k with a match, so it's a defined contribution plan. That way, when the employee eventually retires in 30 or so years, there's no legacy costs. The company contributes to that plan while the employee's working there. It's a fixed cost that goes away when that person retires. So that's going to be a big help. But those are the kind of things that the UAW is going to have to accept as economic realities to be able to compete. And for years, after World War II, I mean, my sense of having grown up in the Detroit area and listened to my dad and my grandfather talk about work in the Detroit area and the auto industry and how dependent everybody was on it is Detroit had kind of a free run after World War II. Germany and Japan were decimated from the war, and the Detroit and the domestic auto industry had kind of a free run for 20 or 30 years. But once Japan and Germany and the other European and Asian countries got their industrial power built up on a par at least close to what the United States had, then all of a sudden we had real serious competitors that we had to deal with. And then when you threw in the oil embargo in the early 70s and some of the other economic downturns that the United States went through, it brought everybody up to the same level as us. So the UAW was slow, in my opinion, to realize these economic realities and come to the understanding that they couldn't, there was no more free lunch. They couldn't just milk these domestic auto companies, Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler, for every penny they could get out of them, in not only in wages, but in benefits also. And it was like a 20 or 30 year period for them to realize that they had to make some real concessions. And they fought it every inch of the way. But I think we're at the point now, with the most recent contract, and then coming to the realization that they had to go to a defined contribution type retirement plan, and they had to go to a lower base pay wage scale. They're starting to come to that realization. So I think there's a future for the UAW. They also have to realize that they're a bargaining agent in the collective bargaining process for their membership. They're not a political organization. They can't keep jumping into bed with corrupt politicians like Kwame Kilpatrick and Hillary Clinton and Democrats, because they've built up an alliance with them. They have to get back to being an agent in the collective bargaining process for their membership and dealing with the issues out on the plant floor.
Okay, so you opened an important subject here. When I drove into the parking lot, I saw the big Trump decal on your car, and now we have a chance to talk to you about why you were interested in Donald Trump and what's your reaction to him after the first 100 days.
Well, I'm 100% supporter of Donald Trump. Number one, because I think the mess that this country is in economically and in a number of areas is due to career politicians. And Donald Trump...
How many of your fellow workers feel the same way about Trump?
Anecdotally...
UAW workers.
Yeah, the UAW members at my plant, and I'm just going to give you an educated guess. I would say the plant that I work at, the Sterling Axle plant, roughly 50% of my coworkers voted for Donald Trump. And this is in spite of very heavy lobbying by UAW leadership to vote for Hillary Clinton. And I would say, in spite of that, right around 50% of my coworkers voted for Donald Trump.
Now that's the Sterling plant, Sterling Heights, which is in Warren.
Yeah,
it's in Macomb Heights. County,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Which was Reagan Democrats, if you go back to when Reagan was elected. How similar would that voting percentage be throughout the UAW? Because you are in the heart of
Democrat country.
Working class people who show that they will swing to a conservative that they like. But is that true for the rest of the UAW membership?
I can only take a guess, John, but I think it would be pretty representative. Now you were talking earlier about how the domestic auto industry is centered so densely around the Detroit area.
Yeah, we were talking about that in the green room.
Yep. And I think that the plant I work at is pretty representative of the rest of the Ford and General Motors plants and even Chrysler plants.
The reason I say that is the UAW admits that a quarter of its membership voted for Trump.
They're lowballing that number to save face, because they're so heavily...
they've lost anyway, so it doesn't matter, right?
Right. Their credibility, when they make an endorsement of a politician, I mean, we get an endorsement card before the elections that is sent out, mailed out to all the UAW members, and I still get them even though I've resigned from the union. Let me make this point, too. I'm still represented by the UAW. They negotiate for everybody within the bargaining unit,
right,
and I'm in that bargaining unit.
But you know what they call you? A freeloader.
Yeah, they call me a freeloader.
Because you're not paying any money for them to negotiate
right
on your behalf.
Because I resigned from the union based on principle. They stole some money, and I use that term stole because they never accounted for that money, and it disappeared.
So this is $300
million. $300 million out of our strike fund. And so I'm standing up. In my mind, I'm standing up for the membership of the UAW. And I stood on principle and resigned. I took a lot of heat. I got a lot of harassment for doing what I did. But I'm fighting for the membership, whether they understand that or not.
Okay, but pre-right to work in Michigan,
yes,
every UAW member had the right
to resign.
You couldn't resign. But what you could do is say, I'm not going to pay for any political activism. I will pay, however, for you to bargain on my behalf.
Right, and that's
why didn't you do that?
I did for a period of time. That's called filing for your Beck rights. There was a Supreme Court decision in the 1980s. A gentleman that was in a union protested the fact that part of his dues, I believe it was for abortion, they were using some of the dues for some pro-abortion cause, and he sued in court and said his dues money should not be allowed to be used for that. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in his favor. The gentleman's last name was Beck, and the Supreme Court ruled that he could not be forced to belong to a union and pay dues and have that money used for a cause that he did not support. And so the ruling allowed him to stop paying that portion of his dues that was being used for political purposes that he supposedly did not agree with. Now, this may be something you didn't know, John, but you have to resign from your union to do that, even though you don't give up your representation. You're still represented by the union because you're in that bargaining unit, but you have to resign from the union.
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, and that's a fact. You have to resign from the union first, and then you can file for your Beck rights, and they'll only bill you for that portion, which is, in the UAW, it's about 70% of your dues that go directly towards negotiating representation and grievance procedures.
Hey, so let's get back to Trump here.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're 100% supportive of Donald Trump.
Yes. He's more than that. And we got to get into that, too.
150%, whatever the percent.
Absolutely.
But I want your reaction to the first 100 days because, of course, the mass media is all up in arms. You have a large percentage of the population that basically identifies as resistors, people who are trying to now resort to the impeachment process, and a lot of innuendo around what's going on, what might have happened or didn't happen in Russia to perhaps reverse the results of the election. How do you feel he's actually doing in the first 100 days?
I think he's doing fantastic, and the reason he hasn't been able to accomplish more is because he's getting zero support, absolutely zero support from anybody on the Democrat side.
Well, that should be no surprise whatsoever.
It's not really.
I mean, declared war.
Obama didn't get a whole lot from the Republicans,
right.
So let's be fair
on
that.
Yeah. But you take them off the table immediately, and then you have the infighting within the Republican
Party.
That's
the real problem.
Right. And that's
for him.
For him, because they have majorities in the House and in the Senate, and he's in the Oval Office. So if they really all got on the same page, they could accomplish whatever they set out to do. But you got a lot of infighting within the Republican Party, and then you've got the media, who's part of that swamp that Donald Trump has said that he's going to drain. So what's happening is the media is putting out all these stories trying to tie Trump to the attempts to influence the election, that, you know, the WikiLeaks leaks and the people who hacked John Podesta's emails and got a lot of things that have never been disputed. That's all factual stuff that John Podesta and Hillary Clinton were emailing back
Ross
and forth.
Ross Perot used to call this gorilla dust. He says, you know, if you watch two gorillas fight, they throw a lot of dust up in the air to kind of make a commotion and a ruckus. But it doesn't really amount to very much.
So the media is not on Trump's side. And a lot of folks get all their information from the mainstream media. And, public opinion's kind of shifted a little bit against Donald Trump, although his base supporters like myself, who don't trust the media, are still with Donald Trump. But some of the people that were kind of in that middle 20% are starting to have doubts. They think maybe there's something there. They think maybe there was some kind of relationship between him and somebody in Russia. So he's losing a little bit of the public support that he had. But I think he's doing a great job, and I think judging him after the first 100 days was just a complete joke. I think the The time to assess how well he's doing will be after at least 6 months, maybe a year. And then the real test will be the midterm elections in 2018. That's when people get to go to the ballot box and really cast a ballot and say how well they think Donald Trump and the Republicans are doing. So they've got another 18 months or so to get their act together, but I think they better do it. I did get to meet Donald Trump during his campaign. I met him in Nova. I got my picture taken with him. And when I met him, I invited him to Macomb County, and I reminded him about the Reagan Democrats and how the people who may traditionally vote Democrat, UAW members and other union members and moderates, are famous across the country in Macomb County. And I invited him to Macomb County, and I told him about a venue there called Freedom Hill. And I said, Freedom Hill is surrounded by 7 or 8 automotive plants right in the center of Macomb County. And I said, Mr. Trump, if you come to Macomb County and ask for the Reagan Democrats' support and you get it, you might win Macomb County big enough to carry the state of Michigan. And I said, if you win Michigan, Mr. Trump, we both know what that means. You win the White House. So 3 days before the election, that Friday before the Tuesday election, I got a phone call from somebody in the Trump campaign, and they were asking me about the venue that I described to Mr. Trump in Novi in September. And I told them, yeah, that's Freedom Hill. And I gave them some contact information. They got a hold of the ownership over at Freedom Hill. This is on Friday night. And by the next day, they had a signed contract in hand, put it up on their website that Trump was going to come to Freedom Hill in Macomb County on Sunday. And we packed that place with 15,000 Trump supporters on Sunday. And he went on to carry Macomb County by 50,000 votes and won the state of Michigan by 8,000 or 9,000.
So you're the guy who got Trump elected.
Well, some people have suggested that, but I did play.
So are you on some kind of suicide mission? This is what I want to know. First, fact, resigned from the UAW.
We just got Sad Radful just wrote in to say, Brian is spewing poison on a system of institutions that were the bedrock of America's growth.
You know, the unions have done a lot of great things, and I've never denied that. I think collective bargaining is a great process. I've always said that what the unions need to do, in my opinion, is get back to being the agent in the collective bargaining process for the workers. Get out of the political world, and there's certain things where occasionally they'll have to weigh in on a political issue, trade imbalances and trade laws and different things, but they need to get their focus back to the shop floor where it began, and become unions that represent the workers on the shop floor again.
But, Brian, you know, I understand what you're saying on that. Let's come back to Trump for a moment.
Sure.
The guy lucked out getting to be president. I mean, he squeaked in by the skin of his teeth. Hillary never came and campaigned in Michigan until it was too late. She never went to Wisconsin. She never went to Pennsylvania like she should have.
Right.
I was just up on Mackinac Island for the policy conference where all the politicos get together and talk. Obama's campaign co-director was there up on the stage, and what her analysis of she wasn't in the Hillary campaign, but her analysis was Trump didn't win it, Hillary lost it because of what I just mentioned. She didn't campaign in those three key states. But what I'm getting at is, aren't you troubled by the fact that, okay, his base, like you, support him, but he has alienated so many other people, and it's who's going to decide the next election? It's going to be the independents. The Democrats will never vote for him.
Sure.
It's the independents.
Yep.
And in politics, if you don't grow the tent, you're toast.
Yep. Yep.
And the way I see it right now is this guy's going to be toast.
Well, I think we're judging him too early. He's only 4 months into his administration. I think to give any kind of an analysis or assessment.
6 weeks is a long time in politics, John. You know
right.
That.
Things can turn around. And I would say we shouldn't really have tried to talk about his, you know, possible reelection in 3.5 years, 3 months into his administration. I think we need to give him a little bit of time. He's going to appoint another Supreme Court justice. He's probably going to get some tax reform package through the Senate and House.
Look, they came in. The Republicans said they were going to repeal health care. Nothing.
All right, Brian,
happened.
Is he good for former and current UAW members?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And why?
He's good for business. He's good for, and you see it. I mean, I could name 5 or 6 examples where he's met personally on a one-on-one basis or picked up the
you
phone.
You know, Mark Fields, he's fired now. So,
well, yeah. But, you know, Ford was a target of a lot of criticism from Donald Trump. And, you know, so I think I think business leaders appreciate the fact that, number one, he's going to reduce a lot of the unnecessary regulation on businesses that make it tough and more costly to do business in the United States. He's going to reduce the corporate tax rate dramatically. That is going to happen, and it's probably going to happen in the next 6 months. So that's going to dramatically reduce the cost that businesses are paying to do business here. So jobs are going to start coming back. And like I said, we need to allow Donald Trump and his policies 6 months to a year for things to get passed and implemented, and then another 6 months or an additional year for those policies to take effect before we can really analyze how well his policies are affecting the economy and different industries in the United States. So that two-year mark, the midterm elections, are really going to be when people get to voice their opinion on how well Trump has done.
Can I ask you as a Ford worker what you think of the change at the top at Ford Motor Company with Mark Fields and Jim Hackett?
Well, Alan Mulally was a great, great leader, and I don't think anybody could have come close to doing the type of job he did, and not only saving this country, but getting it turned around, consolidated, focused on its real core mission and what it wanted to do. And he handed Mark Fields a great company that had been downsized and was really humming along, and not to mention the fact that the economy was doing real well, and the auto industry in particular had turned around, was doing very well, record sales, 17 million sales a year. So Fields was really handed everything on a silver platter. Now, I don't know what the internal board of directors' concerns were with Mark Fields. I think the mobility issue, wanting to get on board with the driverless cars and everything is like a huge focus. And I think my suspicion is the board of directors didn't feel that Mark Fields was the guy to lead us into that new technological realm that we're about to go into, John, the kind of stuff that you guys normally talk about in this program. Right. Maybe Mark Fields wasn't the guy to lead us into that. And I think the new CEO is somebody that's more capable of getting us into that area of the auto industry.
Mm-hmm. Gary, you were going to say or ask something?
I forgot.
Okay. Look.
Too much stuff going on.
Yeah.
We're going to have to wrap this segment up now. But, Brian, thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, it was
very interesting point of view.
Very fun. I appreciate being invited on. And anytime, I'd like to come back on and talk to you if you ever want to have me back. I'd love to.
Well, we'll have to have you back because I'm not quite as convinced as you are that Trump's going to get these things done.
Right.
So, we're going to have a reality check.
Sounds good.
We'll definitely have you back on. You're very well spoken. You really know you've done your homework on all these topics.
Thanks, John.
That's the kind of guest we love to have on this show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now because we got to give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Woo, man!
All right. So speaking sort of with the subject, I thought it was very interesting the criticism of the German car industry
by Trump.
So, I. As
you got a number related to that?
Well, I have a number, but we don't have the number. The normal number is not going to be there. But so I decided I would take a look at the number of vehicles that were sold in the United States by VW Group, BMW, Mercedes, and Porsche, because they're called out separately.
Yeah.
And so it comes to 1.3 million a year in the United States, okay, which seems to be a lot. But Nissan sells 1.5 million in the United States.
Yeah.
And you've got Mercedes investing $1.3 billion in their Tuscaloosa, Alabama plant. You've got BMW expanding its facility in Spartanburg.
Yeah.
And Spartanburg is the only place on the planet where BMW makes its SUVs for distribution around the world. And you've got Volkswagen Group expanding operations in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yeah.
So,
what's
the criticism? So,
where's the leverage?
Well, but one thing. Okay, you say 1.3 for the Germans all combined, 1.3 for Nissan.
1.5.
Or 1.5. Look at the dollar value.
Right, but
dollar value is way above what Nissan's doing.
This gets to the point then that they are making highly desirable, expensive cars that we want to buy. No one is forcing us to buy these cars. We can buy Cadillacs. We can buy Lincolns, right? And then I guess you put a period at the end of that statement.
Yeah, no, I...
So it just seems very odd to me.
Well, I think that this is classic Trump. First of all, who knows what he's really up to. He may be trying to negotiate some kind of trade deal with the EU or Germany. So this is a shot across the bow. This is sort of the art of the deal type stuff. He clearly doesn't understand any of this as well as you do, Gary, but that's not going to stop him from giving a speech that will curry favor with people like our previous guest.
I may be running.
So he knows where his base is, and he knows that there are a lot of people who are buy American people, so there's a lot of political resonance to taking a shot at China one day and a shot at Japan the next day and a shot at Germany the other. This does not hurt him. I don't think this springs from his mind in terms of some calculated analysis of inherent unfairness. There's nothing unfair about this. The German auto industry employs a lot of Americans, sells to a lot of Americans, has a very good relationship with the United States. There's no reason we should be throwing bricks at them. But he's doing this partly for politics and partly because at the margins there might be some trade deal he wants.
I just worry about true global competitiveness. I would like to see the products here being desirable there. And we're not going to get that.
Here's
where I think Trump's wrong, because it's a big tax situation. The way we tax things in the United States is at every step of production. You make rubber and you make tires, and every step there's taxes added. And then when we ship something to Europe, they add a 10% import tariff and an 18% value-added tax. So right off the bat, American cars are way more expensive. In Europe, the way that they do this is the value-added tax is only added at the point of sale. If you export it, there was no point of sale in the EU. So those cars are essentially leaving tax-free, and then we add a 2.5% import tariff on them. So huge tax imbalance. That is not Germany's fault. That is the fault of the United States for not trying to do something about this. Now, there has been talk in the Trump administration of having what they call the BAT, the Border Adjustment Tax.
Which is a tariff.
Well, it's a way of rectifying this imbalance, because we're the only major industrialized country in the world that does not have a value-added tax, or in Japan it's called a commodity tax. So this is one of the reasons why the United States is not that good at exporting, because we're exporting products with a full tax load on them.
And we're putting a higher corporate tax on the companies on their profits, too, which is forcing them to keep stuff.
So don't blame Germany is what I'm coming to.
Yeah.
This is a problem
I agree
he can do something about.
It makes no sense, but I think it's got a lot of political power.
Forget all the taxes. Let's just look at the product.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
So
is the Cadillac CTS competitive with the Mercedes E-Class?
Yes. Okay. I believe it is.
Okay.
Would a German say that?
No, they were not, because when you get into the luxury realm...
Would an American say that?
No.
Other than you?
No. Let's
look at the sales numbers.
Yeah, a couple of hundred thousand Americans would agree with me, because about 180,000...
So 4,200 CTSs have been sold this year.
Well, this is passenger cars, right?
And
Okay, you're right. Go ahead. You're right. But what I'm getting at is... doing a brilliant job of designing and engineering and ladening your cars with the latest technology is not enough to be competitive in the luxury segment. It's about brand image, and that takes a long time to build.
It's a long time.
Okay, so...
they're working on that, but it's not going to happen overnight.
No. Nope. Takes decades. Look, the story I love to tell is in the 20s and 30s, Packard was the luxury brand in the American market. And in the late 20s, Cadillac set a goal of surpassing Packard, not in production, not in profits, but in perception as being the epitome of luxury. It took them 20 years to do it. And there was no Mercedes and BMW and Audi and all the rest of them competing, or Lexus and whatever. It was just Cadillac versus Packard. It took them 20 years to surpass them. And that's what I'm getting at is I think Cadillac is doing a great job. but it's going to take another decade.
And it took Lexus probably 10 to 20 years for it to reach the level that people were mentioning it in the same conversation.
I would say 10 years, but if we would go back to Cadillac and Art and Science, which was the reboot of that whole brand.
15 years ago.
It was more than 15 years ago.
15 years
ago. Yeah, so they've already had that time.
Well, they've had 20 years, but they've come along.
But I'm saying 20 years, they did it with no other competition. Today, 20 years, it takes longer.
Yeah, it's rough.
You know, and look at... Has Infiniti achieved this? No. Has Acura achieved it? No.
And they have their own version of a luxury car, which is the tricked out full-size pickup truck, right? And Toyota's been trying to chip away at that for how long? And it hasn't really.
Right.
It hasn't
and
really.
And again, it's that perception.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to pickups, man.
Buy a Ford.
Buy a Ford, buy a Chevy.
You've seen the things. I'd rather push a Ford than drive a Chevy. What else you got, Gary?
Well, I thought it was interesting. You know, as Brian was mentioning, we often talk a lot about autonomy on the show and things going on. And so we saw that Anthony Lewandowski was fired by Uber.
They drop kicked him out of there.
Yeah, and so just for those who are not keeping track of this thing, that Lewandowski was the guy who had spun out of Google before it was Waymo, spun out of there, and created a company, Auto, which was creating autonomy for Class 8 long-haul trucks. And then he sold the company to Uber. And
took a few with him from Google.
Took a few with him, and then apparently took a few files with him.
A few terabytes.
So it's alleged. That's not why he got fired. This has not been established in court. This is what Google claims in its complaint, but this has not been established.
Then why'd Uber fire him?
Uber fired him because he was not complying with what the court told him to do.
He was taking the fifth on everything.
Yeah, and they said, okay, well...
So let me ask you this.
And by the way, he was ordered by the court not to work anymore for Uber, so what was the point of the employment? Plus, they were on the hook for $680 million, which was the price that they paid for his company, but only if he could hit certain performance goals. Which obviously are very hard to hit if you're not working for the company.
Are you saying he never got the $680 million?
No, he left a lot of money at Uber. They didn't give him cash.
Wow.
No,
No, he got the money from selling the thing. Was $680 million.
So $680 million. He did not get the $680 million.
I thought he got the $680 million.
He got
selling.
Some of it. Some of it was contingent on him hitting certain performance goals.
All right, I got to ask you this.
He left a lot of money.
John,
at Uber when
John
he
called you the grizzled guy, not me. I think you're
I'll
like.
I'll happily call you that, Gary.
I think you're
like sunshine and sweetness and just as fresh as morning. So, I mean, talking about this reminded me of a case some years ago with a guy named Lopez who left Detroit and went to Volkswagen. And didn't you tell us about that situation? Do you remember that?
That was the strangest press conference I ever attended.
Give us the background.
Ignacio Lopez was a General Motors executive working in Spain who was thought to be somebody who could make some organizational changes at General Motors. So he was brought over to the United States by Jack Smith, who at the time was the CEO of General Motors. And at that point, they were just about to make him. They put him in charge of production. In charge of purchasing. And the idea was to try to get some of the cost out of and wasted time out of these elaborate purchasing empires. And so they put him to work, and he was doing workshops, and he was going into parts plants, and he was telling them how they could save money for General Motors, because there was really no way before that they had any incentive to save money for General Motors. They passed all the costs along to General Motors, and this was... being felt on the bottom line at General Motors and making it very uncompetitive. So he was really getting some traction, very much a controversial guy, much hated, but then...
Much hated by suppliers.
Much hated by suppliers, much hated by rivals within the company. He was very controversial.
He was doing unethical things. He was taking the intellectual property from suppliers and then shopping it out to their competitors and showing them their technology
Right.
And saying, hey, who can beat the price on this?
Right.
What he was doing was...
That was the allegation.
Listen, I got to tell you, I had a great working relationship with Inyaki, as everyone called him. I admired so much of what he did. But I'm telling you, the guy did a lot of stuff that was absolutely unethical. And Jack Smith stood behind him. So while all the suppliers hated Inyaki, they all loved Jack. And I thought... He's just saluting and doing whatever Jack Smith is asking him to do.
Well, and this is what General Motors had to be doing at the time, or okay, it would have gone bankrupt anyway. But anyway, they were about to make him president of North America, and suddenly he jumped ship 20 minutes before the press conference to go to work for Volkswagen, and allegedly took a whole bunch of intellectual property General Motors.
Proven in court.
Proven in court. I guess it was a plant design or some kind of particular...
Oh, he walked out with boxes and boxes and boxes of then CDs. There were no jump drives. And he took several of his top lieutenants who also brought boxes of stuff, and they were all caught red-handed with the stuff, by the way, by German investigators.
Right.
So. I only read about this stuff. I was really young, and
you
guys
were that
fluid at the time.
You guys were living it, and
So
it reminded me of that. You know, this whole thing of somebody jumping.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Exactly.
Is what you're trying to say.
Exactly right.
Yes.
Exactly
absolutely.
Right. And so, sort of segueing back to German companies. So this week, BMW. Got an export license that they can begin exporting BMWs from China. I saw that Volvo is now availing itself of the Silk Road train route, bringing cars, S90s, from China to a port in Belgium. There were a number of deals signed this week by Continental Automotive with Chinese companies.
And Baidu.
Baidu, the big search engine company that's the Google competitor in
which
China.
Is working on driverless.
And then with NIO, which is an electric car company. So I got to ask you guys, is this going to become the Chinese century in terms of the auto industry?
Absolutely. Not just the auto industry. This is going to be China's
century.
For
many industries.
Really?
Oh, yeah. No, China is going to emerge as the superpower in the world. And in fact, there was a great book that came out, I want to say it was in the late 1980s, called The Rise and Fall of Great Nations. I highly recommend it. It's absolutely relevant today. And that was one of the predictions of the book. And what it looked at is 1,000 years back in history, going back to Roman times, and looking at great nations and why they rose and why they fell. And it determined, the author of the book, whose name escapes me right now, is that countries to be great have to have three.
The guy's name was Kennedy, I think, wasn't it?
It might have been.
Yeah.
Might have been. But not related to Kennedys, right?
Not that Kennedy. Who turned 100, by the way, if he would have turned 100 years old this
week. If he was still alive today.
If he's still alive.
But anyway, they said you have to have three legs to the stool. You have to have a real balanced economy. You have to have a strong military. And you have to have a stable society. And if any one of those three things gets out of whack, you start sliding down the scale of great nations. And one of the points that this guy made was in 1900, Britain was the richest country in the world. Britannia ruled the waves. Today, every Briton has far more personal wealth than any of the Britons of 1900. They live longer. Their quality of life is far higher. But Britain is no longer rules the waves. And what got out of whack was, because of World War I and World War II, its economy just wasn't able to... They ran up massive amounts of debt. And so even though everybody in Britain today lives far better than any one of them did in 1900, it's not a world power. And what that guy was saying was that it's inevitable that China rises to be a number one power. Why? Because of the size of its population. It has a population that's...
The stability of its society.
Right.
The military power.
Right.
And the economy.
And the economy.
Now, if any of those things have a hiccup, and they could,
and they
for
will,
instance,
my prediction.
Then that could change. But if they don't, I think you're right.
But here's the thing is China has four times the population of the United States. All they have to do is hit one quarter of our per capita income, and they've matched the size of our economy. And they did that in 2015. If you look, and, you know, the CIA, anybody can look this up on the internet, the CIA World Fact Book. And the CIA does an analysis of every single country. It's all clickable. It's easy to look up. in 20, and they measure an economy on what they call purchasing power index. So they don't look at the raw dollars of the
economy. The Economist does the same thing.
Yeah, they look at what can those dollars buy. And the CIA is my source on this, surpassed the economy of the United States in 2015. So when you ask, is this their century? You bet it is.
Okay, so are Americans, North Americans, and Europeans going to buy Chinese cars?
They're already doing it.
Yeah. You know, Buick Envisions and Volvo S90s, and and you don't just focus on Europe and the United States. Look at Latin America. You can't believe the number of Chinese cars
really?
Out there.
Right.
Look in Africa. You can't believe the number of Chinese cars.
They started
there. Look
there.
At
the,
Asia.
The export business started right. there because they were dealing with consumers that did not have the same level of expectations as European and U.S. consumers.
Well, price was far more.
Okay, right. So now they're ready to move into those markets, and they are doing it already. And I think you can see it more and more and more. To your point about these export licenses.
Okay, so if the Chinese are selling their vehicles, trying to stay with vehicles here, guys. Come on, let's cars. Okay, if they're selling more vehicles in other markets, and then we see situations like the General Motors pulling out of India, selling Opel. Didn't Ford announce some changes in terms of global sales, or am I wrong on that?
I haven't heard that.
But I mean, aren't we retreating while they're expanding, and shouldn't we be expanding while they're retreating?
We've already been retreating. I mean, we're already less of a force as an automobile society and industry than we were in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Why? I mean,
because the competition's tougher, just because of what Brian said before. Germany and Japan, they were basically destroyed in World War II, and China was a closed society until 1970. They had nothing there. Everybody was running around in Mao uniforms, and nobody had a private car.
I don't understand. I mean, we had more practice at building stuff.
I think part of what they've got going for them is a kind of homogeneity as a society. There's a great desire to succeed economically. They have a big worldview. They feel that they've been held back. They have a great stability with regard to politics, which is done partly by repression, partly by the Confucian principles that daddy is always right and you have to listen to what daddy says, and partly because of a great reverence for education. So there's this great thirst and hunger for knowledge and education. If you've been there, and I know you have, and you have, and I have, you see everywhere people are carrying books, people are carrying laptops, people are new universities are going up everywhere, and people want to learn.
So work hard, study hard, and have a big vision.
Yeah.
And that helps. But, you know, there's a couple of things. And let me preface this by saying I believe this is China's century until the Civil War breaks out there. And I do think
that
will
happen.
And
that's where the hiccup could
happen. That's where
Because there's a great desire. I think many of the Chinese I've met who come to this country like the amount of freedom that they have here, to do whatever they want, to worship as they want, to go where they want, to express themselves in an open way that just isn't done in China.
Yeah, but here's the other thing, too, Gary, getting to your question there, is look at the way that the Japanese did it. It was Japan Inc. This was a policy of the government that didn't look just benignly on the car companies, but on the entire vertical. And same with the Koreans. And now the Chinese are doing the same thing. And so it's... Here you got General Motors trying to not just fight off Ford and FCA and the Europeans. They're up against the country of Japan. They're up against the country of Korea. They're up against this monolith, this megalith, and growing by leaps and bounds, China. And, boy, that's hard to fight against.
So, I mean, is it conceivable, though, that, you know, we were talking earlier about autonomy, and we do have companies that are making great strides in that. That if we get there first, that we win?
I wonder about that. We talk a lot about who's going to get there first and who's going to have the first driverless system, and I wonder if it's almost beside the point who gets there first with the actual technology. The question is who's going to exploit it in the smartest way from a business perspective.
I think it goes beyond that, because if you run this thing out to what I think its logical conclusion and saying we're going to share a whole lot more and they're going to be autonomous— and there are several studies out that show this. we don't need nearly as many cars as we got right now. And this is an industry that's predicated on scale. So there's a study out right now by a group of economists out of Stanford U called Rethinks that is saying that the SAR is going to go from today's 17 million-ish to a SAR of under 6 by 2030. Now, I don't think their timeline's right, but I think their logic of where this is going is correct. I don't think it'll be 2030, maybe 2040. And if you do believe that all of a sudden, in a fairly short amount of time, a decade or two, that's pretty quick in automotive terms, that you are going to see this great shrinkage, to me, this makes a whole lot more sense in explaining why General Motors sold off its entire European operations, pulled out of South Africa, Australia, Indonesia, India. And you're starting to see, I think, GM's going, hey, wait a minute here. If this is where we believe it's going,
so the microeconomics,
time to pull back.
Okay, but to your point, you were talking about the SAR. That's here. That's just in this country, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the rest of the world where there are far more vehicles added to that number, right? We have places like, you know, you were mentioning that in Africa that there are a lot of Chinese cars, right? So here's the entire continent of Africa that probably has a minuscule number of cars compared to what we have.
Sure.
In the parking lot right now.
Sure.
That's
to me, one of the fundamental questions is when the economics of driving changes and it's no longer needed to own a car, you're buying rides, you're not buying cars. When I come over to the studio today, I call somebody, the car is there, I come over, come back, I work on the way here, I work on the way back, and it costs me a quarter of what it would have cost me in my own car. Do people travel more? Will
yes.
people travel
yes,
more?
Yes, absolutely. Anytime that you open up a service to more people, and think about it, when it's sharing now the very old, the very young, people with any kind of disability, and to your point, when you take the cost down, of course there's going to be more people driving.
Yeah.
But we probably will not need as many vehicles to be able to deliver all those miles.
They're going to be working nonstop.
Around the clock.
They're going to be working nonstop, and we're going to need a different kind of infrastructure because we're going to need more roads, better roads, wider roads, roads that might not even have different
robot cars. They'll be driving in such great order, it'll be fun.
Or maybe we don't even have cars.
Yeah.
Maybe we climb in the drone and the drone takes us where we're going to go.
Not in our lifetime.
I wouldn't be so sure. You know, somebody's opening a service in Dubai this summer to take you from downtown to the airport.
A drone.
It's a big drone.
They call it an airplane.
No, and it's not a helicopter.
They call it a helicopter.
It's not a helicopter either. It's like a two or four. Google it. You know, look it up online. You'll find this thing. And it's a quad, you know, four rotor thing with a couple of seats in the middle and a canopy on it.
Some guy sitting on the ground with his iPhone. So is anybody asking us any interesting questions?
Let's see here. Oh. Mike from San Francisco says, Donald Trump just announced he's withdrawing the United States from the Paris Climate Agreement. What do you guys think?
I couldn't care less. I think the whole thing's overblown about us being in the climate agreement or not. I think innovation is going to come when people want it, and not because 100 nations tell you you have to do it.
I just continually worry that we become less globally competitive if you've got other countries that are saying, you know what, the amount of CO2 emissions is not sustainable, therefore we are going to develop technologies for cars that will help reduce that. And we're like, what the hell, we don't care. Doesn't matter to us.
We already have electric cars here. I mean, we've already got zero emission cars.
No, but when
we
that
zero
number
emission power plants
when,
is what
when
we
that
need.
Number ramps, okay, and when the Chinese are ahead of us in this game, then we're going to say, "Gee, that was a really good idea."
I don't think the Chinese will be ahead of us necessarily because it's a global industry, and GM, Ford, and FCA, and anybody else who operates here is going to have to be able to compete globally. But it does take the U.S. out of a leadership role in the world, and that does trouble me.
No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, again, it's down to competitiveness in being competitive, and I think we need to do everything, which gets back to the working hard, being highly educated, and having a big vision. We've just taken the big vision out of this.
Okay, here's another question, and after this, we're going to have to wrap up. But Peter Egan asks, is it better for the U.S. to focus on the highly profitable parts of the industry and let contractors in China, Mexico, Thailand, and India produce the body and do the assembly?
So if we look at the famous Clayton Christensen, The Innovator's Dilemma book, we basically see that his argument is that there has historically, whether we're talking about disk drives, which is where he did his original work, or we look at automobiles, which he does mention in the book, that basically everybody wants to go up. But what ends up happening is that those at the bottom who basically are not offering as much fulsome technology and capability as these guys who are higher up end up taking over. Therefore, it'd be very simple to say, yeah, we'll just let them do that other stuff, and we'll just take the cream off the top.
But you know,
but it doesn't work that way.
Apple designs the most beautiful products and doesn't build any of it. Foxconn builds it. Foxconn, I believe, if I've got my numbers right, is the largest employer company in the world. It has over 1 million employees. And I've often wondered why Foxconn didn't go, you know, we've learned an awful lot. We know all the innards of what it takes, all
maybe
the guts.
Maybe it just hasn't happened yet, according to what Gary says. Maybe Foxconn...
Or the other way of looking at this is that the Apple brand is so incredibly valuable on a global scale, which has been proven time again when I used to bring those things in. We'd have that thing about, you know, what's the most... You know, I mean, that if you had your choice, right... I mean, and this goes back to the point of, like, the iPod was successful, the Microsoft Zune didn't work, right? And I would argue that the technology in the Microsoft Zune was every bit as good as an iPod.
Yeah.
But it's the Apple brand, right? So that's why that doesn't work. But, I truly think that what you end up having is you lose your capability to do stuff, right?
If you don't manufacture.
If you don't manufacture.
Though Apple has proven that's not true. But they're an exception, I think.
I mean, because if you go back in time, I mean, Apple built its Macs for a very short period of time. I mean, they were never a manufacturing company. And if you look at it, what Silicon Valley company is a manufacturing company? They're all design and engineering companies. So their model is different. This industry is an industry that is based on making stuff.
It is, but it's getting less and less so because automation is taking jobs out of the factory. And some of this will be done by hand.
I think that's overblown. I really do. I hear a lot of people say, oh, you know, all the manufacturing jobs are going away because everything's getting
automated. I didn't say all the manufacturing jobs are going away, but they're getting less and less and less.
And if we have a 6 million SAR, geez, we'll be like, manufacture all the cars in here.
That's right, in the studio here. Hey, we are going to have to wrap this up. I mean, we could go on forever, but we're not going to do that. Daron Levine, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the next opportunity.
Yeah. No, we'll definitely have to have you back. And then, Gary, you and I are going to have to keep on doing this.
All right. Till 2020 when I'm...
Real good. And we want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.